Well, good evening, fellow diplomats and members of the Foreign Service. I realize it's kind of a cheesy way of opening, but as we get into this evening's last presentation, I think you understand why I said this. I think you're going to realize very well why I said this. So, Game of Gods, Encounters in Divine Identity Theft. Divine Identity Theft, the first encounter of this takes place in Genesis chapter 3, when we declare that we can be as God. And from then on, we have been living a divine identity theft. I'll give you a little bit about my background so you know who I am. Yes, I'm a local boy in terms of the prairies. I come from Manitoba. I was born and raised in the Gladstone area of Manitoba. My wife, Leanne, I'm not sure where she is. She's here somewhere in the corner. Thank you. Came along with. We have two adult children. And I've been researching global transformation since 1992 and full-time since 1997 when an author by the name of Gary Koss, some of you I know have read his book, had me come on and was his chief researcher for 4 years. And then for a time, from 2007 to 2015, I edited and produced a magazine called Forcing Change, which was all about trying to understand those forces of change. And then just recently, got a book done, which was really, really nice, a weight off of the shoulders, so to speak. And one thing that's important to know, I mean, when you see this, you go, okay, he's a family guy, he does stuff. Every speaker that comes up here is just a man, just a person, no different than you. We are believers in Jesus Christ, and we're coming to you with a message, and we're hoping that you will be challenged, that you will learn, but we're just men like you, people like you. My research style is a little bit unique. I am a firm believer in boots-on-the-ground research. I like to go where the action is, and then come back and report it to you, to report it to other authors, to media hosts, and then to incorporate that into my own writings and my own presentations. And here's just a small smattering of different events. I've been to, I don't know, 35, 40, maybe more events in terms of world religions, paganism, the United Nations and global governance, and on it goes. And this talk will be incorporating some of that in. So, if you haven't had a chance to read through this crazy big book, and it is a big book, by the way, if you say, and my friend Trevor, as Ray told me, it's taking me a long time to read this, that's okay. It took me a long time to write this. Seriously, yes. But what I'm going to be doing tonight is just going to be sharing little snippets of some of the things we're pulling from this book, including some of the core tenets, and hopefully bringing a challenge through it. Why? Why do something like this? Why have a ministry like this? Because it's a little different. It's not Bible prophecy per se. It's not apologetics per se. It's worldview issues. It's other things all kind of colliding all together. And it dovetails. It fits together. Why? Well, first of all, to know where the Christian message is being challenged, where the message is being challenged in your own life, to be able to see past the trappings, and right to the heart of the matter. To recognize when the culture itself is preaching to you, because the culture is constantly preaching to you. I do a course at Miller College. It's a modular course, a 20-hour course on secular pagan trends. And one of the assignments I have my students do is to do an essay, and I encourage them to take something that interests them in their life and then to unpack it in terms of what is the messaging. It's interesting how many students have done essays on gaming, on video games, and the messages being given to them through that venue, or certain favorite movies or television shows. And you realize that indeed the culture is preaching to you constantly. Why we're doing a workshop like this is to help you see past the packaging and recognize that indeed we're being sold a worldview. And then to be responsible to your family, to your church, to your young people, to the people who are important in your life, as you also recognize where the challenges are coming in, right at the local level. And in all of this, and this is so important, that you can become an effective ambassador for Christ. And this is why I opened the way I did. In 2 Corinthians, we read this. This is Paul speaking. Now then, we are ambassadors for Christ, as though God were pleading through us. We implore you on Christ's behalf, be reconciled to God, for he made him who knew no sin to be sin for us, that we might become the righteousness of God in him. Okay, I love Paul's comparative language. He talks about being a farm laborer. I get that. I'm from a grain farm. I'm a farm boy. He talks about being a soldier for Christ. I've never been in the military, but I have friends who are in the military, and we can figure that out pretty quick, what that looks like. Paul talks about being an athlete, running a race. I can run fast when I'm scared, but I'm not very good in terms of an athlete. But we all understand what that looks like. Who here has been a part of the diplomatic community? Anybody here worked for an embassy or for the Department of Foreign Affairs? Yes? Okay. Very rare when I ask that question, does anybody put a hand up? So can you tell me what an ambassador does? Right. Can you unpack that? Allow me to give you some, just kind of a handle of what it looks like to be an ambassador. Many years ago, I attended a conference in Chicago where the U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia was giving us a breakdown of his new posting as a member of the diplomatic community. And I'm converting it into Christianese so we can grasp what he was talking about. The U.S. ambassador said that, first of all, he is the official and legal representative of his government. You, every person in this room who is a follower of Jesus Christ, is a legal and official representative of the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. I can't think of a higher calling than that. You are literally the legal representative. You are the official representative in a foreign land. Listen, whatever you're doing in your life, wherever you find yourself, you are a representative of the King. That's an incredible calling. Absolutely incredible. An ambassador knows the King's position and power. The ambassador knows and represents the King's interest and not his own. And indeed, you subservient your interests to the King's interests. You change your interests to reflect his interests. That's what an ambassador does. Third, an ambassador takes the time to know the customs of the land he finds himself being positioned in. He needs to know the culture. He needs to understand the dynamics. He works through trying to understand its history. This is something the U.S. ambassador brought out very clear. And it's interesting. He made it also very obvious that although you study it, you are set apart from it. You are in it. You find yourself positioned in it, but you are not of it. That's a really interesting principle, isn't it? It's a biblical principle. But that's what an ambassador does. And in so doing, the ambassador is looking to do two primary things. First of all, to effectively communicate the King's message in that foreign land, regardless if it is friendly or hostile. That's not the issue. The issue is, are you communicating the King's message? That's the question. And then to recognize, and ambassadors do this, the diplomatic community does this, looks for the challenges to the King's message, and then the ambassador goes out to the diplomatic community and say, hey, listen, everybody, this is where challenges are coming from the land I'm positioned in. Hold your ground. Be aware. In a sense, that's what I'm doing tonight with you. So, we need to know, first of all, what our King's position is. And then we're going to take a look at a series of examples of divine identity theft. I love Isaiah 40. It's been kind of my hallmark passage as I've been wrestling through really the fundamentals of how the world situation has changed. Isaiah chapter 40 reads this. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, comparing God, measured heaven with a span, and calculated the dust of the earth in a measure, weighed the mountains and scales and the hills in a balance? Who has directed the Spirit of the Lord, or as his counselor has taught him? With whom did he take counsel? Who instructed him and taught him in the path of justice? Who taught him knowledge and showed him the way of understanding? Behold, the nations are as a drop in a bucket and are counted as the small dust on the scales. Look, he lifts up the isles as a very little thing, and Lebanon is not sufficient to burn, nor its beasts sufficient for a burnt offering. All nations before him are as nothing, and they are counted by him less than nothing and worthless. To who then will you liken God? Wow. Let's unpack this a little bit. God is being compared to nature. I love the language. I used to do road construction. I used to do surveying work. I loved it because you could see the big picture all unfold. That's the same kind of language. He measures it in the hollow of his hands. He sees it all. Can you compare this God to nature? No. Utterly incomparable. He is outside of nature. He is outside of creation. Can you compare him to human wisdom? Did he call you this morning and ask, what do you think I should do today? Has he said, hey, put a council together, maybe a group, maybe your collective human wisdom, you can tell me what I need to do? No. He is far beyond our wisdom. He is far beyond the collective human wisdom of all of humanity. To the nations, are as a drop in the bucket. The symbolism is important because this pulls out of that ancient context. Back then, there was a cistern. You would literally lower down a bucket on a rope, and you would pull the water out. And those last drops that mean nothing come down. And that's how he is comparing the power and might of nations. They are nothing more than those last drops. They count as nothing. They count as nothing as the dust. The small dust on a scale counts as nothing. You know the kind of dust you don't have in your home? That little bit that's under the bed and in the corners? That kind of fine dust, the language is, that dust is on the scales. Does that compare to God? No, no, no. You can just go and blow it away. Not that it has any bearing on the scale whatsoever, but you can blow it away because you can. It means nothing. That is how we compare and how God is compared to the nations. And then even our models of worship. What does that mean, the whole idea of Lebanon sufficient to burn? In this passage, here we go. He lifts up the isles as a very little thing, and Lebanon is not sufficient to burn, nor its beasts sufficient for a burnt offering. What does that mean? Again, the context, that ancient context, Lebanon was noted for its great forests and for its cattle. It would be this: take and cut every tree down in Lebanon, mount up a phenomenal, incredible altar, slaughter the cattle on the altar, mount it up. It would be enormous. It would be a mountain. And you would stand back and go, God has to be like this. No, your model of worship is insufficient. It does not compare. It would be like us tearing down every church, every single house of worship across Canada and around the world and building a superstructure, something so awe-inspiring, something so immense and actually terrifying, we would walk into it and go, drop to our knees, wow, God has to be here. No, no, your model of worship does not compare to who he is. So, consider that. And consider the fact that you are the legal and official representative of that king. What do you have to be afraid of? Really, who do you have to be afraid of? Not man, not man. Let's take a look at the sufficiency of Christ. Colossians says this, for by him all things were created that are in heaven and that are on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers. All things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things consist. And he is the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead. And in all things he may have the preeminence. For it pleased the Father that in him all the fullness should dwell, and by him to reconcile all things to himself, by him, whether things on earth or things in heaven, having made peace through the blood of his cross. There is the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. So this is who our King is. This is who we represent. I want to switch gears a little bit. I want to switch gears into the challenge. But I want to couch it, first of all, in a very interesting model, a model put together by my friend Dr. Peter Jones, taking a look at what is ultimate reality and how is it composed. Is ultimate reality oneness? Is it one-ism? Or is it two-ness, two-ism? How is it ultimately composed? Otherness or oneness? Oneness says this: man, God, and nature are all essentially the same. There is no fundamental distinction ultimately between God, man, and nature. That is oneness or one-ism. Two-ness or otherness, this is not dualism, by the way. Dualism says two opposing sides having equal power. No, this is two-ness or otherness. God, separate, distinct, holy, completely beyond compare. He is not the creation. He is the creator. It is God first and then creation, God and everything else, two. And now, how you look at those two questions, what does ultimate reality break down into, oneism or twoism, will determine how you look at law, ethics, morality, sexuality, gender. If you want to know where the gender clash is really coming from, really, really down to its nitty-gritty, it's the clarion call of oneness. There are no binaries. There is no separating points. We're all part of this grand, great oneness. And the moment you say, no, there is a division, there are value distinctions, there are separating points, you have now just fired a shot over the bow of oneness. And they are angry. So how you look at oneness or two-ness, otherness or one-ism, will determine so much about how your worldview unfolds. So oneism is found in the Bible, absolutely. Genesis chapter 3 and Romans chapter 1 both demonstrate oneness in a very profound way. Genesis 3:5, for God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like or as God, knowing good and evil. In Romans 1, we read this: who exchanged the truth of God for the lie, and worshiped and served the creature rather than the creator. Take the time, sometime, even the next 2 days, to read through Romans 1. It's really interesting. Because as we bow our knees to creation and not creator, as we bow to nature, we end up following a path of sexual, social change. It gets very convoluted, very complex, very disturbing, very different. Because we are ultimately breaking down the idea of oneness, or pardon me, of separation and value distinctions. And we're saying creation is the same as God, as the same as man. And we are the masters of our own meaning and destiny. So, we can't conceive of a God being outside of creation. And we refuse to acknowledge his position. We can't fathom a God whose existence is not tied to natural processes. Therefore, nature is divine. We can't comprehend a God whose separateness, his holiness, levels everybody out. Kings, princes, paupers, poets, it makes no difference. All are sinners in his eyes. And that levels us out. Therefore, we bend our knee to what is created, and we choose our own spirituality. We enchant ourselves. What's really interesting is the God of the Bible has to reveal himself to us. We can't imagine a God. We can't even make up a God who stands outside of time, space, and matter, who is distinctly different than creation because we have no reference points at all. So he has to reveal himself to us. And he's done that through his word, first of all, to Abraham, and all the way through. We see him in action as he reveals himself to us in a way that is relational. Not relational, by the way, as in puppy love, a teenage relational kind of sense, but more in the relational sense of a father who is waiting for his prodigal to come home. So this brings us around. We are now entering, and I believe this very strongly, in fact, that's a big tenet of my book, we are entering the age of re-enchantment. We are going beyond postmodernism, and I make the argument that the postmodern mindset, though it is still here in spades, already 20 years ago, saw a shift, and we are now embracing what I call re-enchantment, and I'm not the only one calling it this. What is re-enchantment? It is the age of oneness, where we collectively determine and celebrate and pronounce that we are ultimately our own gods. It also focuses on ourselves as well. So this is what re-enchantment ultimately looks like. Tell me if this doesn't sound a little bit like today. We begin by creating some new mythos, some new identity frameworks, a new truth claim that becomes wrapped up in a grand vision or story. It's a planetary interconnection. We're all one. We have a new myth. We have a new reality that we're looking to connect with. And really, we're going to talk about that in a couple of minutes, and you're going to see this. In fact, we celebrated just earlier this week, called Earth Day. A soul-like sense of contact with natural processes. It's a pagan veneration of nature. It's the return of Gaia, our sacred earth. It's personal and group gnosis. It's a feeling-based, experiential sense of spirituality. Have you not heard this? And I know you have. I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual. What does that mean? Really? You did yoga until something snapped? I mean, this is Canada. You went and toked up until something happened. I don't know. What does this mean? What it really is meaning is this. I don't want to talk about ultimate truth claims. But I've had a feeling, and I like the feeling. And then that feeling becomes authenticated by others, the group, the mass, crowd gnosis. And we now all collaborate with each other in that respect. Meaning and purpose in re-enchantment is found in divine destiny, found in finding a divine destiny with a material universe. We direct our own evolution. And this gets into the technical side, and we awaken the cosmos because we are the directors of evolution. Is this a New Age movement? It fits into it, but it's not. It is one and the same in some respects, but there are some key differences. The New Age tended to focus on the self. Self-actualization, self-identity, a self-realization, the divine self. And it was viewed ultimately becoming very shallow, really, because it was nothing for you to really grasp a hold of beyond your own search for experiences. And one was never enough. You kept hunting and looking and hunting and looking. From crystals to tarot cards, you just hunted and looked, because there was no sense of a grounding. Re-enchantment focuses instead on the we, the community of all. Now that we, the community of all, can incorporate everything from nature to the spirits of nature. It incorporates us all as the earth community. It is really the new global Babel. As we shake our fist at God and say, we are now the masters of our meaning and destiny. It is, in that sense, a new type of spirituality. And we sense this and feel this in our oneness. An interesting survey was done in the year 2000 to try to gauge where the Western world was, particularly the United States. 1,600 households were surveyed. And in this survey, 43% agreed with this statement: God is something separate from me. Now, that's actually a biblical statement. That's correct. God is separate from nature and me. The fact that 43%, which sounds actually really good, agreed with that statement seems kind of hopeful, but then hold on, that still means the majority disagreed with that statement. Okay. And then ask this statement, or to respond to the statement, Earth is a kind of living organism and as a whole is fundamentally alive. 81% agreed. Underneath it all, we are connected as one. 85% agreed. So I'm going to give you a few just little snippets of what oneness looks like, and we're going to unpack this a little bit more. The United Nations International Day of Yoga, which is coming around in at the end of June, June the 21st, the statement was given by PM Modi, Prime Minister Modi of India, speaking to the United Nations General Assembly when he was introducing the idea of the International Day of Yoga. And by the way, in the men's room, I don't know about the ladies' room because I didn't go in it, but in the men's room there's a poster for yoga, come and do yoga here. So hey, it's everywhere, right? Very spiritual. Very spiritual. Religious? Yes, it is. Yoga is an invaluable gift of India's ancient tradition. It embodies unity of mind and body, thought and action, restraint and fulfillment, harmony between man and nature, a holistic approach to health and well-being. Yoga is not about exercise. Not about exercise, but to discover the sense of oneness with yourself, the world, and nature. Years ago, and I documented in the book, I spent some time at the Krishna Temple, the Lotus Temple in Utah. Everybody thinks about Utah in terms of Mormonism. Yes, Mormonism is the heartbeat of Utah. But if you go roughly 100 miles south of Salt Lake City, there's one of the largest Krishna temples in the U.S. And so I went down there and spent time with the guru. I wanted to know, why is this here? It's in Spanish Fork, Utah, which is predominantly a Mormon county. And so in the course of our afternoon talk, he made it very, very clear that we Hindus, we are evangelizing the West. And we do it through yoga and the Holi Festival of Colors. And that we are not, in Western our Western world, we are not becoming Hindus in that we are converting to their faith. No, we're not converting to their faith, but we are embracing their spirit. And we are becoming Hindus in spirit. We are becoming Eastern in spirit as we also adopt the practices of oneness. PM Modi is absolutely right. He knows it. He knows it better than anybody in this room. He knows it. It's about oneness. So what does oneness look like? Well, in Eastern religions, reality is one. We're all returning to the one. That's yoga. That is the Eastern worldview. It's the same with classical neo-paganism. Neo-paganism, or the classical versions, nature is the embodiment of divinity. Humanity and nature are one. You can commune with the nature spirits. In the occult, it is through ritual. Mankind acts upon the all. You are now manipulating the cosmic forces of oneness. Cosmic humanism. New Age movement. It's our collective humanity. We're evolving as agencies and agents of divinity. And even secular humanism, atheism, ultimately says there is nothing higher than man. Man is the measure of all things. Therefore, man, by definition, is divine. Something to think about. So this is the heart of Mormonism. I appreciated, Don, what you were saying earlier about Mormonism. Especially the Follett Discourse. Thank you. Joseph Smith in the Follett Discourse says this, God himself was once as we are now, and is an exalted man, and sits enthroned in yonder heavens. Here, then, is eternal life, to know the only wise and true God. And you have to learn how to be gods yourselves, and to be kings and priests to God, the same as all gods have done before you, namely by going from one small degree to another. That is oneness. You can square that off with the square and compass. That is oneness. You have just made a divine claim. You have engaged in divine identity theft. So, heart of masonry. I'm going to give you three quick quotes. All of them from Masonic authorities. First, Joseph Newton, and then J.D. Buck. Here lies the great secret of masonry, that it makes a man aware of that divinity within him. J.D. Buck says it this way. J.D. Buck was a very respected Masonic scholar and theosophist. It is far more important that men should strive to become Christ than that they should believe that Jesus was Christ. Jesus is no less divine because all men may reach the same divine perfection. And then Buck says this, every soul must work out its own salvation and take the kingdom of heaven by force. Salvation by faith and the vicarious atonement were not taught, as now interpreted by Jesus. Humanity in toto, we. Humanity in toto, then, is the only personal God. I'm sorry. No, it's not. No, we're not. It reminds me, well, I'm going to give you a couple more quick quotes. I'm going to have to, before I rabbit trail. This is also the same message that you get with channeled UFO messages, with channeled extraterrestrial messages. I find it interesting how, and I've got a large collection of channeled literature in my library, and as you read it, what's fascinating is, why did you come supposedly billions of light years away to teach me Shirley MacLaine, Saving the Environment, Al Gore, and David Suzuki? Why did you do this? I mean, really? If you go through their channel messages, it's basically the New Age. It's green spirituality and Karl Marx. I think I know where you come from. And it's not, you know, light years away. At least not in the physical sense. So consider this channeled message. The second coming is imminent, and you may as well get ready. This is a particularly good idea because you're it. You are the second coming. Become your own Messiah. Why wait? Really? You know, it reminds me, and this is where my rabbit trail goes, years and years ago, back in 1999, I went to a couple of lectures given by the Dalai Lama of Tibet. And he was describing to us how he had already seen centuries and millenniums come and go, which is really a divine, you know, a statement of divinity. And then he was also telling us in the group that he had a skin problem, and he does, and he has thick eyeglasses because he has poor eyesight. And he was surrounded by U.S. Secret Service. And I thought to myself, buddy, if I bought you at the God store, I would return you as defective. I'm sorry, you just don't quite match who God is. Become my own Messiah? Are you kidding me? I don't want to get out of bed in the morning. I feel like garbage a lot of times. I do garbage a lot of times. Become my own Messiah? Seriously? No. Good luck with that one. I'll give you one more quick example, two more, from the extraterrestrials, our space brothers. This is from Solera. These are pictures from Solera's 1992 ritual when they tried to reawaken the angelic beings. And the group still exists, by the way. We are called to unite together in a group initiation as one, binding the family of humanity into a collective whole. Our primary identification with ourselves shall be with the one which we truly are, you, me, and everyone else combined. That's oneness. It's interesting. John Mack was a noted researcher in the UFO community. He's passed away now. He, in his book, Passport to the Cosmos, he interviewed a number of UFO abductee survivors. This is what he said. Consider the oneness language that's packed here. The altered consciousness that abduction encounters bring about resembles in some ways the trance state of shamans. And like indigenous peoples, abductees are brought closer to a natural world that is alive with spirits of all kinds and is increasingly perceived as sacred. Now, Mack realized that there was four fundamental worldview changes happening with these abductees. First, there was an awareness of a collective unconscious, a sense of connectedness. Second, there was a spiritual, psychological expansion, the idea that they're all linked now to gods and goddesses, to the divinity, to the all. Third, a type of heart opening, a great sense of compassion and loving connection with all living beings and with creation itself. And number four, a renewed sense of the sacred and a reverence for nature. This is all oneness. He has just described to you what I went to a couple of weeks back, 4 weeks, 6 weeks back, in Minneapolis. Again, I do boots-on-the-ground research. And so on March 22nd to the 24th, I was at Paganicon. It is the conference for Paganistan, the nation of Paganistan, the heartland of America's pagan community, which is the Twin Cities. There are enough pagans in the Twin Cities that they consider it affectionately Paganistan. So I went to a conference of theirs. I've been to a couple, and I document in detail the 2017 Paganicon event in my book. And it's interesting because it was a gathering of about 800 witches, Satanists, Luciferians, Neo-Pagans, Druids, heathens of all sorts. And repeatedly throughout the event, it was noted that this is a religion, a religious movement of nature, connecting to the spirits of nature, connecting to the powers of nature, as we harness and can become part of a community of spirits and nature and man. And it was all about oneness in a very tangible, powerful way. So I'm going to quickly jump into two examples of re-enchantment, the big we, and how this plays out in a couple of different ways. First of all, I'm going to go back to last week Monday. You all know what last week Monday was, right? Earth Day! Yes, we are told all about Earth Day and how important that is. Well, where did Earth Day come from? Earth Day began back in April 22, 1970, as the first national teach-in on the environment. The context here is the Vietnam War era, and there were peace teach-ins, anti-war demonstrations, and Gaylord Nelson, a senator from Wisconsin, believed that what we needed to do was have a national environmental teach-in in the United States. And so this book, The Environmental Handbook, was published for the very first Earth Day and distributed to schools across the United States and in Canada. My copy comes from my high school library. Yes, little old Gladstone, a town of 800 people, we were using that in our classrooms. You were too, you just don't remember it. For those of us, especially us guys, who'd like, you know, school, gone. But this was where it began, this sense of we need to have a reverence for nature. And it's interesting, if you want to do a survey, a study of Romans chapter 1, you just look at what happened in the first stages of Earth Day, the late 60s and early 70s, along with the social and cultural and sexual revolution, it all gels together. As we worship and serve creation, our sexual identities, our social structures all changed. Paul was right. Paul was absolutely right. So what did the Environmental Handbook say? Well, first of all, the problem, the environmental problem is you. You are the problem. And not just you as humans, but you as Christians. What we do about ecology, and this is from the book, depends on our ideas of the man-nature relationship. More science, more technology are not going to get us out of our present ecologic crisis until we find a new religion or rethink our old one. No new set of basic values has been accepted in our society to displace those of Christianity. Hence, we shall continue to have a worsening ecologic crisis until we reject the Christian axiom that nature has no reason for existence to serve man. So what was the solution? Page 331 gives you solutions. And I document the whole thing in Game of Gods, quite detailed, by the way. And it's interesting, page 331 lists acceptable religions to replace Christianity. Gnosticism, hip Marxism, mystical Catholicism, Judaism, Taoism, witchcraft, Quakers, the list goes on and on. All primitive cultures, all communal and ashram movements. Page 331 says this, life won't seem worth living unless one's on the transforming energy side. You want to get on board with this train. Right, kids? As we shove this down our throats all the time. Listen, do you want to pick up your trash? Please. Do you want to do some recycling? That's all right. No big deal. It's not about that. It's about something else. Totally about something else. The Environmental Handbook said this. The other problem goes back to Genesis, the idea of families. Freedom to breed is intolerable, so it's said on page 41. No technical solution can rescue us from the misery of overpopulation. Freedom to breed will bring ruin to all. This is 1970. I think there was 5 billion people at the time. Keep in mind, too, who the audience is, school children. Approximately 20 million Americans participated in that first event. This sunk re-enchantment deep into our heart and soul. It is sinful for anybody to have more than 2 children. It has long since become glaringly evident that unless Earth's cancerous growth of population can be halted, all other problems, poverty, war, racial strife, uninhabitable cities, and all the rest are beyond solution. Wow, kind of sounds like you might read on, you know, or hear on CBC regarding climate change, right? We've heard this before. So what are the solutions? The Environmental Handbook gave solutions: legalizing abortions, voluntary sterilizations, removing restrictions on birth control information, make sure that this goes all the way down to the minors, make sex education available. Here's another one: explore other social structures and marriage forms, such as group marriage, polyandrous marriage, share the pleasure of raising children widely. We must hope that no one woman would give birth to more than 1 child. You might be going, what in the world is that? What is a polyandrous marriage? What are group marriages? Well, I'll tell you, when I attended a few pretty important events, Burning Man being one, and we've got a couple of friends here who've attended with me to a regional Burning Man event, and I'll talk about that tomorrow. Polyamorous relationships, that is heavily being talked about because that's the next stage. Same sex, then group contractual marriages, and we'll move on and on. There's some very interesting things developing. James Coburn understood what Earth Day was all about. The actor James Coburn, remember him? He's passed away, but this is an interview he gave with Carol Matriciana, a Christian researcher, in 1990. Mother Earth is our mother. She's the mother goddess. She's the one that we should be praising rather than raping. I mean, all these people here today are here for one reason, because they're concerned about what's happening to the Earth, what mankind is doing to the Earth. What we have to do is be true to ourselves. If we're true to ourselves, we'll be true to Mother Earth. Mother Earth's going to be bountiful. She's going to give us everything we need. She has for a long time. We've lost our way. The pagans used to know how to do it, and the Indians, some of them still remember how to do it. The Earth is a living organism. We're killing the one we love the most, and she loves us. We've got to praise our Mother Goddess. That's just oneness, folks. It's oneness. It's re-enchantment. So we celebrate Earth Day. We have it all around us. And again, this is not about don't clean up your mess. It's not about don't doing stuff. This is about understanding the worldview behind what we're doing. And in fact, if we want to have a theology of nature, we need to look at who the Creator is. Then we can figure the rest out. Praise the Lord from the earth, you great sea creatures, and all the depths, fire and hail, snow and clouds, stormy winds, fulfilling his word, mountains and all hills, fruitful trees and all cedars, beasts and all cattle, creeping things and flying fowl, kings of the earth and all peoples, princes and all judges of the earth, both young men and maidens, old men and children. Let them praise the name of the Lord, for his name alone is exalted. His glory is above the earth and heaven. We want to have a theology of how we deal with the environment. Let's look, first of all, to the one who created the environment and recognize that praise goes to him and honor goes to him and loyalty goes to him, not bowing our knee to creation. I'm running out of time quickly, though Larry did say I had 3 hours this evening. I want to quickly shift gears and demonstrate how this sense of oneness comes through even on the technology and scientific side, and that's on transhumanism. What is transhumanism? Well, first of all, it's the idea that through our science and technology, we can take hold of evolution and we can reshape man in our own image. Here's an example from an Esalen workshop back in 1995, as already back then they were discussing what does a sense of re-enchantment with machines look like? Is information immortal? What unexplored realms of spirit will we encounter? That's an interesting question. What unexplored realms of spirit will we encounter with amazing new forms of computer and electronic hypermedia? New myths will be needed. New mysteries will be encountered. How can ancient models of mind, such as shamanism, Hindu, or voodoo, help us comprehend silicone-based consciousness? Why are neuroenhancers crucial tools for so many computer innovators? Can humans share an erotic relationship with a machine being? Are Earth spirits at play in fields of photons and electronic spin? A neo-psychedelic subculture is co-evolving with new technologies to reveal glimpses of exotic futures. Oh, indeed. Oh, indeed. Mark Peace, one of the pioneers in virtual reality, said this in his documentary, Becoming Transhuman. Once the genome was Once the genome was transcribed, once we knew what had made us human, we had, in that moment, passed into the transhuman. Knowing our codes, we can recreate them in our so-called synthetic rows of ones and zeros, artificial life. And now we have discovered the multiverse where nothing is true and everything is permissible. And now we will reach into the improbable, resequence ourselves into a new being, debugging the natural state, translating ourselves into supernatural, incorruptible, eternal. There is no God but man. Genesis chapter 3. Read Genesis chapter 3. This is divine identity theft through the works of our hands. So very quickly, I'll take you to a couple of events. In 2013, I had the opportunity to go to the Global Futures 2045 International Congress in New York City, where we had roughly 800 of the world's leading experts in technology, scientific development, psychology, philosophy, all coming together to take a look at what it means to be transhuman, what it means to evolve through our science and technology beyond the human state. It was about directing our own evolutionary steps. Ray Kurzweil, the director of engineering from Google, is a rock star in the movement. He was there. Peter Diamandis of the X Games was there. The list goes on of techno innovators. And we were shown incredible technologies, amazing advances, some phenomenal discussions of where technology was going, from brain-computer interfacing, which is already an old technology, but we are now just moving it forward into the masses, to advanced robotics. In this picture, we have Dr. Ishuguru and his Gemini double, his robotic double. And it was amazing. From you and me away, you would not be able to tell that this wasn't a human being. Very advanced. By the way, only a few months ago, in January, Dr. Ishuguru unveiled a Buddhist deity robot, which is now being housed in a Japanese temple. And I've got a picture of the Japanese monks all standing around venerating the Buddhist techno deity. Really interesting stuff. So we saw some pretty far out stuff. And if you all might be thinking, well, this is crazy stuff. It doesn't happen. How many of you have smartphones in your pocket? Yeah, you're all connected. Don't kid yourself, folks. And it was all very spiritual. We closed at the end of this event with a interfaith panel. Tomorrow I'll be talking a lot about interfaithism in my first talk. These are some of the comments that came out of the interfaith panel. We're forming a race of God-men. We're developing a God-like civilization. One of the luminaries said this: you are the light. You are the truth. You are the beginning. You are the end. I'm sorry. You are a plagiarizer. I know who said these words, and you just strung together. You plagiarized this and engaged in divine identity theft in the process. Jaron Lanier, one of the pioneers of virtual reality, offers this warning, and it's a warning. I appreciate Jaron Lanier's perspective. He's a brilliant man who has been deeply involved, and he sees dangers.
But if you want to make the transition from the old religion, where you hope God will give you an afterlife, to the new religion, where you hope to become immortal by getting uploaded into a computer, then you have to believe that information is real and alive. So for you, it will be important to redesign human institutions like art, the economy, and the law to reinforce the perception that information is alive. You demand that the rest of us live in your narrow conception of a state religion. You need us to deify information to reinforce your faith.
Wow.
So let me take you to the Mormon Transhumanist Association. Oh, by the way, this weekend, before I forgot my little notes, I wrote to myself, in Edmonton, Singularity University, this weekend, like right now, I mean like right now, is having a major conference on artificial intelligence, taking you down the road of the transhuman in Edmonton today, right now. Did I say right now? Yeah. This is not far off in the future. This is not science fiction. This is now. And so let me take you really quickly, I know we're running out of time, to the Mormon Transhumanist Association's conference in 2013. The Mormon Transhumanist Association, by the way, I've got friends in the Mormon Transhumanist Association, I've rubbed shoulders a lot, as you'll see in a few minutes, is the largest religious organization promoting transhumanism. This is what my friend Lincoln Cannon, who is the founder of the Mormon Transhumanist Association, said in 2013, listen carefully to the God talk. Get it to play.
The Mormon Transhumanist Association stands for the proposition that we should learn to become gods. And not just any kind of God, not the kind of God that would raise itself above others, but rather the kind of God that would raise each other together. We should learn to become Christs, saviors for each other, consolers and healers, as exemplified and invited by Jesus. In fact, the religion Mormonism itself is an immersive discipleship of Jesus Christ. It's not so much a religion about Jesus as it is the religion of Jesus. With Jesus, we would trust in, change toward, and fully immerse both our bodies and our minds in the role of Christ. And we would also endure in that role, working to reconcile ourselves, our relations, our world, and even do that through suffering and death if need be, anticipating the day of transfiguration and resurrection, immortality, and eternal life in a fullness that this afternoon our keynote speaker, Richard Bushman, will be speaking more about. So while we may not be Christian by creed, we're plainly Christian by gospel. And I hope that Carl Tyker will say a few things about that. Carl will be talking about giving a Christian criticism of religious transhumanism. I'm looking forward to that. Mormonism is also a school for prophets. The name of the religion itself reminds us of a book that would extend the Bible. And the way it would extend the Bible is in part by claiming that yet other books would also extend the Bible. And in turn, that book reminds us of a man. And that man would speak and act for God in part by saying everyone should speak and act for God. The Book of Mormon and Joseph Smith are not fortune tellers, but rather forth tellers. They would express a sublime aesthetic, a Holy Spirit, provoking us to speak and act so as to fulfill their prophecies, in part by learning to become prophets ourselves. For some, prophecy is not a living proposition, let alone religion or God. They wonder if perhaps we've not heard that God is dead. And they're right to wonder. Following their gods, traditional religions do seem to be dying, particularly in technologically advanced and prosperous places. And observing this, many have embraced the secularization hypothesis that religion itself is dying. However, that hypothesis is showing its age, and it's now embraced more by anti-religious voices in popular culture than by experts. among whom another hypothesis is coming of age. If God is merely a supernatural superlative, he very well may be dead. But positing such as God misses the function of God. God always has been and is at least a post-human projection, an extension and negation.
God is post-human extension. Now, interesting. I know some of you might be going, wow. I think heard from people directly. One of the things when I go to events, let me tell you, there's an empathy that develops, friendships develop. These are people. Lincoln Canada is my friend. These are people. Our worldviews are in collision, absolutely. But he has respect for me and I respect him. And at the same time, we recognize that indeed what we are seeing here is just another example, really, of Genesis chapter 3. So what did I say to the Mormon Transhumanist group? What could you say? I was given a 15-minute period to speak. That was just accepted. That's what we all had. And so the bottom line is this. I went to the cross. Jesus on the cross in Luke 23. And in the cross, in that passage, we know that there's a thief on either side. One is chastising Christ, and the other thief is saying, hold on, listen, don't you fear God? This man, speaking of Jesus, is an innocent man. And then there's a dialogue between Jesus and this other man. At the end of the dialogue, Jesus said, today you'll be with me in paradise. But the thought hit me, what did Jesus not say to that man? What did he not say? He didn't say, go do good works. He didn't say, go find a technological solution to your problem of death. He didn't say, go join the priesthood, go do rites and obligations and rituals. He didn't say any of that. And that's the point. There was nothing the thief could do. Nothing the thief could do except trust on the one dying beside him. A powerful, powerful picture. Because that's all we could do. Is trust on the one who gave himself for us. Who is, by the way, the author of life and could raise himself again. So this is where we're at. This is the challenge to us. We are living in an enchanted worldview and it's all around you. I'm going to skip a couple of quick slides. This is one that really bothers me. This is Barna and Summit's research that was done just two years ago, yes, approximately 27% of Christians believe in some forms of oneness and spirituality. 27% of American Christians said this, meaning and purpose comes from becoming one that with all that is. It's in our midst, absolutely. So what's our response? What is our response? We need to be ambassadors for Christ. If you're just coming to listen, and that's all, well, that's fine, but I hope it stirs you to recognize you, everyone in this room who calls himself a follower of Jesus Christ, is an ambassador for Christ, every one of you. So you need to speak love and truth into the setting you find yourself in as you are his legal representative. So what's our responses? First, the church needs to rediscover our first love in acknowledging God for who he really is. Distinct, exalted, holy. He's not your buddy. God's way bigger than that. Second, the church, we need to clean up our own act because we are living and playing with forms of oneness all the time. And Don, thank you for talking about yoga in the church. Absolutely. Third, we need to equip the saints. That's what we're doing here. That's part of what we're doing in this conference. Equipping you so that when you see it, when it's in front of you, you recognize it. And then helping you to work through, even in your own mind. Listen, I can't give you a handbook one-on-one how to answer every question your neighbor has or your child has. But hopefully this helps start to spur what your responses will be. Not your actions, not your reactions, your responses. Wisdom says this, trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him. He will make your paths straight. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and shun evil. Fear the Lord because he is different than the created universe. and shun evil. 1 John 5 says this, and we know that the Son of God has come and has given us an understanding that we may know him who is true. And we are in him who is true, in his Son, Jesus Christ. This is the true God and eternal life. Notice it's not what is true. It's who is true. Bang on. It is who is true. And this is your response. This is what you are to be as ambassadors. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It isn't good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Let your light so shine before men. Listen, the early church, if you would go back to the time of Peter and John and Paul, was living in a context that was so raw with its paganism, you would shudder. You would shudder. We have it easy in comparison. We really do. If their light can shine then, your light can shine today. Shine your lights as an ambassador for Christ. The Great Commission in the Old Testament, I'm going to wrap it up. Psalm 96 says this. This is your job as ambassadors, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, sing to the Lord a new song. Sing to the Lord all the earth. Sing to the Lord, bless his name. Proclaim the good news of his salvation from day to day. Declare his glory among the nations, his wonders among all peoples. Proclaim the good news of his salvation from day to day. Hey, thank you so much for being a part of this evening, for coming out for the first day of the conference. God bless you, folks.